VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Katie Weaver. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak slowly, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Faith Perlow and Mario Ritter Jr. bring you the Higher Education Report. They look at a study that identified one reason why some American students struggle with math. Then, Ana Mateo is here with words and their stories. She discusses a kind of writing that is not creative, but necessary. After that, Kelly Jean Kelly brings us the first part of our report on one of the most famous U.S. presidents, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. But first, this story about large ocean fish from Brian Lynn.
A new study has warned that warming ocean temperatures could threaten some of the largest fish in the sea. Many scientists believe warming waters are directly linked to the effects of climate change. Research has shown that rising sea temperatures are especially dangerous for larger fish because warmer waters can harm their open water environments. In one recent study, researchers estimated some larger fish species could lose up to 70% of their environment or habitat by the year 2100. These habitat losses could largely remove some of the most economically valuable fish species. The Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts carried out the study. The warning comes after temperatures around the world reached record highs in July. Some scientists blame the Pacific Ocean current, known as El Niño, for the recent heat waves. Large fish, such as marlin, skipjack, and others, live in areas considered among the fastest warming. Cameron Brown is an ocean scientist and the lead writer of the Woods Hole study. He told the Associated Press that temperatures in those environments are expected to rise as much as 6 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. Such increases would likely start a widespread displacement of the animals, Brown said. For sure, their habitat will change. How they respond to that is an open question, he added. For large species, longer periods of warming can be harmful because of the animals' temperature needs, said Janet Duffy Anderson. She is chief scientific officer at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute in Portland, Maine. Duffy Anderson said large fish are often highly migratory. Increased warming could result in some species moving to northern or deeper waters in search of normal temperatures, she added. The Gulf of Maine lies off the northeastern U.S. and Canada. It is warming especially quickly. This is expected to cause big population movements, especially for species of marlin and tuna. Large fish are important to healthy oceans because many of them, such as white sharks, are predators serving as critical pieces of the top of the food chain. some species are also economically important to humans as food. The possible loss of large fish is one of the many results of warming oceans that scientists have warned about this year. One study said the collapse of ocean currents that transport heat northward across the North Atlantic could happen by mid-century. In Florida, federal ocean researchers said some ocean coral were losing their color weeks earlier than normal because of record temperatures. Penny Becker is with the Seattle-based environmental group Island Conservation. She told the AP the threat to large fish is another reason to raise awareness about the different ways climate change is affecting sea life. If you're missing these components of these larger fish species, that's a missing hole in the ecosystem, Becker said. I'm Brian Lynn.
Many elementary school teachers say they dislike the idea of teaching mathematics, even at the most basic level. That is a cause for concern among educators. Experts say it is critical for students to have a solid foundation in the subject, because math skills build on each other. Research published by the National Institutes of Health, NIH, found that math is a common cause of anxiety for adults, especially for women. About 90% of elementary teachers in the U.S. are women. The NIH study suggested that, in the field of education, anxiety can have a harmful effect on learners. International studies have found that U.S. students are behind many other democracies in math skills. In 2017, the OECD, an international economic research group, ranked the U.S. 30th among member countries. Since the worldwide COVID-19 pandemic, the math test scores in the U.S. suffered even more. Educators now say an important step to improving math skills after the pandemic is to increase the confidence of elementary school teachers. The Erickson Institute in Chicago is a graduate school centered on child development. The school holds a yearly math conference where elementary teachers can ease their anxiety about math. Teachers find out how young children learn math and plan activities for the classroom.
Jennifer McCray is a research professor at Erickson. She said the best way to see how a child will perform in math up through eighth grade is to learn how the child did in math when they started kindergarten. Teachers are worried that they will transfer their math fears to their students. Math specialists say this is a persistent issue in elementary school classrooms. Elementary school teachers are expected to teach every subject, often leading them to spend less classroom time on math. During the Erickson Institute's summer meeting, teachers work with math concepts that they can use in the classroom. For example, the group built 10-sided shapes out of colored blocks. These exercises help the teachers with their own math skills. Lauren Solarski is a trainer with the Early Math Collaborative at Erickson. She told a group of educators, "There's a misbelief that in order to teach early childhood math, you don't really need to know math well." Lisa Jeanette is the director of operations at Erickson. She said that early childhood teachers do not necessarily need to be experts in complex math subjects, like algebra and geometry, but they need to understand that many of the skills they are teaching are connected to mathematical thinking and to subjects that students will learn later in school.
Stacy Stevens works for the Kentucky Department of Education as the director of the Early Childhood Education Training Center. She said she changed her study major in college to early childhood education to avoid high-level math. After she completed a year-long class in math to improve her teaching, she finally started to understand how to teach the subject. Stevens said she was passionate about teaching preschool because she did not want children to have the same struggles in math that she had growing up. "I wanted them to understand that four triangles make a square, to actually see it and do it, and not just be told that a triangle is a fourth of a square." Heather Pesky is the president of the National Council on Teacher Quality, NCTQ, a research group based in Washington, D.C. She said colleges need to better prepare teachers to teach math before they get into the classroom. The NCTQ studied teacher preparation programs in 2022. It found that most do not spend as much time on elementary math content as NCTQ thinks is necessary. The recommendations were based on studies that linked student achievement to teachers' math studies in college. Pesky said if we prepared them better, they would be stronger at both their math knowledge as well as their ability to teach math, and this would reduce their anxiety and improve student outcomes. I'm Faith Perlow.
And I'm Mario Ritter Jr.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. Today, we talk about a type of writing, boilerplate. Boilerplate language is the writing in documents, such as contracts. The language is standardized. This means the words are well established and used by many people. The language is widely recognized as acceptable. It is not creative, nor does it change very much. So when it comes to things like business documents, legal contracts, and training manuals, boilerplate is a good thing. You don't need or want creative language in those sorts of documents. However, in writing other kinds of stories, boilerplate has a different meaning. If a piece of writing is not special or creative, we can call it boilerplate. The words hackneyed and trite have related meanings. Hackneyed or trite writing is commonplace and repeated too often. There is nothing special about boilerplate writing. Now let's hear boilerplate used in some examples.
I'm not signing any contract without my lawyer looking at it first. I don't care how boilerplate it is. The writing in the novel was boilerplate. It showed no creativity. The writing job was not difficult for the college student. It was mostly boilerplate type stories.
The website Merriam-Webster.com explains how the term boilerplate came to mean standard or non-creative writing. Boilerplate comes from syndicated stories, used especially by weekly newspapers. These stories were ready to print and required no additional writing. Boilerplate stories were not usually hard news. They were stories that just filled space in the newspaper. So the term boilerplate can mean ordinary, mediocre writing. In the past, these stories were sent on flat metal plates. These story plates looked like plates used to make steam boilers, devices used to make steam for heat or power. So they were called boilerplates. Soon, the term boilerplate came to mean the actual printed material on the plates, as well as to the plates themselves. And that's all the time we have for this Words in Their Stories. Hopefully, you don't find our materials at VOA Learning English to be boilerplate. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
I'm Dan Friedel, and you're listening to the Learning English Podcast. We just heard Ana Mateo discuss a style of writing that is often not very interesting. Ana is here now to talk about a word many English learners may not have heard yet. Welcome, Ana.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Ana, we're glad you could join us. So tell us again which word you discussed this week.
Absolutely. For this week's Words in Their Stories, I picked boilerplate. Now, boilerplate describes two types of writing. One type is the language that you will hear or see in a business document, for example, a legal contract or a business contract. The second type of boilerplate writing means not very special, just average, just mediocre. That's your fancy word, Dan, mediocre.
Yes, that's a good word for our listeners to learn as well. I think the idea about boilerplate is that it can be used again and again in different contexts. Like you can use it in a contract or a different kind of legal document, and you don't have to write it from scratch each time. Does that sound about right?
Exactly. And that is a great idiom. You do not have to start from scratch or start from the beginning. You also, here is another idiom, you don't have to reinvent the wheel with boilerplate writing. It's like almost like a template, Dan, correct?
It's a good starting point, right? Like right. A lot of important documents need a framework. And then you get the two parties together at the negotiating table, and they'll start with the boilerplate and they'll make little additions and subtractions.
For some things, Dan, you do not want very creative language. You just want the facts, a legal contract between two parties, health insurance. I recently had a change of my health carrier, and I looked through the documents, and the language was very boilerplate. It was very similar to my old plan. But for creative writing or journalism, boilerplate has a different meaning. It has a bad meaning. It means it's just commonplace. Maybe the writing has a lot of cliches. Dan, how would you describe or define the word cliche?
Well, a cliche is something that just doesn't require a lot of creative thinking. You hear it over and over again. We talked about cliche and mediocre, but we didn't really talk about very much where word historians think the term boilerplate came from. Maybe you could explain the background of boilerplate to people who are completely new.
For this one, I think word experts agree that it comes from the actual plate that the text was put on and sent to different syndicated small companies, newspapers and other journals. They would take that metal plate, which looked like a boilerplate that you would use to make a steam engine, and they would literally run that story through their printing. This was many, 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 many years ago. Run that plate through the printer, and that would be the language. And so that is where we get the term boilerplate from.
They literally had to attach the words to the plate and then send it out to the customers who were paying for
that. That is my
service.
Understanding. Yeah, the plate would go to the smaller publications. And that way, the writers of that smaller publication did not have to write the story themselves. So these were not hard-hitting news stories. They weren't local stories. They were very general, kind of anyone could publish this type of story.
I think that's a good guess for how this word came to be. Well, thanks for joining us today on the program, Anna. It's always great to have you, whether you're talking about something boilerplate or not.
I hope our writing at Voice of America is not boilerplate, hopefully. Thanks for having me, Dan. It's always great to chat with you about words.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He was related to an earlier president with the same last name, Theodore Roosevelt. Many Americans call Franklin Roosevelt by the first letter of each word in his full name, FDR. When FDR took office, the United States was in a severe economic depression. The previous president, Herbert Hoover, had tried to improve the economy, but his efforts had failed. FDR defeated Hoover in the election of 1932. He won, in part, by promising what he called a New Deal for Americans. Voters did not know what FDR's New Deal meant exactly, but many liked his message of hope. Voters also did not know how much FDR would change the country. He remained in office for 12 years, the longest of any U.S. president, and led the country through the Great Depression and most of World War II. Along the way, he changed the way government affected Americans' lives and the job of the U.S. president. Franklin Roosevelt was born on a large estate in New York, about 140 kilometers outside New York City. He was the only child of wealthy parents. His mother and father made sure he had an excellent education. As a young man, he attended a private high school and then Harvard College in Massachusetts. He also studied law at Columbia University in New York. Young FDR was not an excellent student, however. He was interested in many things outside the classroom, including politics and girls. Two of FDR's interests came together in a young woman named Anna Eleanor Roosevelt, who went by the name Eleanor. She was the niece of a politician FDR greatly respected, President Theodore Roosevelt. On the day when Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt were married, Theodore Roosevelt attended the ceremony. In fact, he walked with his niece in front of the guests to her future husband. Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt went on to have 6 children, although one died as a baby. While Eleanor Roosevelt raised the children, Franklin Roosevelt directed his attention to politics. He left a job in a law office to serve in the New York State Senate. In time, he was offered a job in the federal government as an assistant secretary of the Navy. FDR enjoyed the job, but he continued seeking other political positions. He tried unsuccessfully for a seat in the U.S. Senate, but did get nominated by the Democratic Party to be its vice presidential candidate in 1920. Although he and his partner lost the race, FDR seemed like he was in a good position for major political success. But then, something unexpected happened. When he was 39 years old, FDR suffered major health problems. One day he started to feel a pain in his back. The following day, his legs grew tired. Then his skin became sensitive. By the end of the week, both his legs were paralyzed. He could not move from the waist down. He remained paralyzed for the rest of his life. The next years were difficult for the Roosevelts. Eleanor and the children helped care for FDR, and he worked hard to recover some of his strength and physical abilities, especially by exercising. While he remained hopeful about his condition, FDR worried about his political career. He did not think the public would accept a leader who could not even walk by himself. So he took several measures. He created a small wheelchair that would not get too much attention. It was made from a dining room chair, with wheels instead of legs. He refused to let photographers take pictures of him being carried or struggling to move, and he found a way to appear as if he were walking. He used a cane or the arm of a partner to balance, and then he swung his hips to make his legs move forward. Using this method, FDR walked to the stage at the 1924 Democratic National Convention. He used the event to nominate the governor of New York for president. That man's bid did not succeed, but FDR showed himself to still be an able politician. 4 years later, FDR himself was elected governor of New York. He held the position in the early years of the country's economic crisis. In 1932, FDR was a candidate for president. He took the unusual step of appearing in person at the Democratic Convention to accept his party's nomination. His campaign was such a success that the Democrats took not only the White House, but majorities in both the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives. The strength of the Democratic Party in Congress would help FDR become one of the most powerful presidents the country had ever seen. Next week, we will continue our story of FDR and his presidency. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's the Learning English podcast for today. Thank you, Kelly, for that report. And thanks to our VOA colleagues for their work on today's program.
Most importantly, thank you for listening. For more, visit our website at learningenglish.voanews.com. www.theworldofwildlife.com. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Dan Friedel.